hppodcraft.com.
I break a silence of 3 years to clear the name of Dr. David Throckmorton and to lift the shadow of scandal from that of his wife and of Dr. Charles Stanton, his assistant. That I have not found the courage to do so before, all men who are jealous of their scientific reputations will understand when they have heard what I have written. How strongly I attest to my belief in the truth of what I am about to lay before you will be equally clear as you listen and realize, as I do, the storm of ridicule and disbelief it is sure to bring upon me. Yet I hope that you will also believe before this narrative is finished.
Well, I believe in three things. I believe in a thing called love.
Hmm?
I believe in life after love.
Yeah.
And I believe the narrative of the Moon Pool by Abraham Merritt, also known as A. Merritt. And that's why we're going to talk about it here on the HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lanky. We're here at hppodcraft.com and Patreon. Who was that reader?
Well, you know him, you love him. That was Andrew Lehman.
I do know him and love him.
We haven't had him on the show for a while. It's awesome to have him back. You know what they say? You can't spell gentleman without Lehman.
Oh, it's...
You know that old saying.
They do say that.
As always, Andrew's doing great stuff over at the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society. Go check it out at hplhs.org. They have so much cool stuff on offer. The recent Masks of Nyarlathotep gaming set, all of their Dark Adventure radio theater dramas, so much good stuff.
Chad, I was just in Los Angeles with you.
You were.
And we stopped over at the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society, and Andrew was showing us all the amazing props and things that they have built recently and have for sale. I have to say, it's kind of the Los Angeles Lovecraftian pilgrimage. Like, if you're a Lovecraftian and you go to Los Angeles, you have to go to the HPLHS shop and see all of the amazing things there. It's like a little museum.
It's a little storefront museum over in Glendale, and if you're in the LA area, you have to go check it out. So the Moon Pool, I've heard of this story many times.
Yeah.
That it was a big influence on Lovecraft, particularly the Call of Cthulhu.
Mm-hmm.
But I was a little confused because there are different versions of it. Had to kind of go down the road and make sure we were reading the right one.
Mm-hmm.
What we're covering is the original short story or novelette that was published in All Story Weekly in June of 1918. That's the one that Lovecraft read, that he liked. This story and its sequel, Conquest of the Moon Pool,
yeah,
were reworked in 1919 into a novel called The Moon Pool.
Yes.
Which is different. And the protagonist of that story, Dr. Goodwin, in this story here, Dr. Goodwin, he later appears in another novel by A. Merritt called The Metal Monster from 1920, mm-hmm, which is a cool title.
Yeah.
Lovecraft apparently considered the novel to be inferior to the original short story, so we're doing the original short story, not the novel.
Yeah.
You can find the whole novel online at Gutenberg, but the original short story I found on Wikisource.
Yeah.
You'll know the difference because the short story's first chapter is called The Throckmorton Mystery, whereas the novel's first chapter is called The Thing on the Moon Path.
Ah.
That will tell you which one you're reading.
There you go.
However, even the short story, which is on Wikisource online, it seems to have been edited. Some paragraphs were removed, some language cleaned up. If you really want to read the original, I read it in H.P. Lovecraft's Favorite Weird Tales, that anthology,
yes,
edited by Douglas A. Anderson,
uh-huh,
we've been talking about a lot. Right away, I noticed the differences from the online version, so I think the one in Favorite Weird Tales is probably the best one to read, but perhaps there's a scan out there, the original publication from All Star Weekly. I'm not sure. It's easy to read the wrong version, but that's probably the only thing easy to read about it. I was fine with it, but I don't think you liked it very much.
No, it does really go. I feel like what can be said in a sentence is said in two paragraphs.
Yeah.
It just kind of goes on and nothing new is being introduced, and it's repetitive, I think.
It's a little repetitive, yeah. It's repetitive in theme and language, and even story elements are told to you a couple of times. I could see reason for cleaning it up, but what do we know about this author?
Abraham Grace Merritt was born in 1884 in New Jersey, but he moved to Philadelphia when he was 10 years old. He studied law and journalism, becoming a correspondent eventually, and then an editor. He was the editor of the American Weekly from 1937 until his death. He wrote 8 novels and a ton of short stories, but it was just side work for him because his journalism was his primary job. In fact, he made big bank as a journalist, one of the highest paid journalists of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But he was an odd dude, I read about him. Now, this is coming from one of the versions of Moonpool has an introduction which talks about his biography.
Mm-hmm.
And this is from that. It says he had a lot of strange hobbies like cultivating orchids and plants linked to witchcraft and magic. So like, you know, monk's hood, wolfsbane, peyote, cannabis, you know.
Right.
Eh?
Yeah, I swear I'm only cultivating cannabis for my occult studies. Same with those blacklight posters up there. Totally academic because
yes,
they're linked to witchcraft.
He was described as a hypochondriac who talked endlessly about his medical symptoms and showed eccentric behavior like a need to try out any food, tobacco, or medicine he found on his coworkers' desks.
That's so weird. I mean, if he's just taking random meds from people's desks, then yeah, he probably is getting sick a lot or having weird symptoms. That's got to be a weird coworker to learn about on your first day at the office, right? Look, don't leave any sandwiches out unattended or the editor will just come and take a bite out of it. Any pills, too. He'll just take them.
Yeah, it said occasionally he would dress in a kilt and play serenades for his coworkers with some of his... He had a very huge collection of instruments that he kept in a locked closet at work because he didn't want anybody else playing his instruments. But he was well-liked, supposedly. People liked him because he was very fair, and he had an inability to fire any of his employees. Kind of get away with murder working for that guy.
That's the best quality any boss can have, the inability to fire you. But that makes it sound like a really fun workplace. I wish I could get an office-style documentary about it. He's playing weird instruments in his kilt and eating people's sandwiches. And he can't fire anybody, so they're probably just lazy not doing anything. Sounds great.
He was heavily influenced by Robert W. Chambers and Madame Blavatsky, who was the Russian occultist and founder of the Theosophical Society. You know, Lovecraft was really into her stuff as well. We covered Merritt briefly before in that he was a contributor to The Challenge from Beyond with Lovecraft, Howard, C.L. Moore, and Frank Long. His part was the second part.
Right. Yeah, we covered that way back when we did the live show in Leeds.
Yes.
Seems like a very long time ago.
Oh my God.
In Douglas Anderson's foreword of the story, he does note that Lovecraft actually met Merritt.
Yeah, in January 1934, Merritt hosted Lovecraft to a dinner at his club in New York, which Lovecraft described in a letter to R.H. Barlow. He said, "Merritt is a stout, sandy, gray-eyed man of about 45 or 50, extremely pleasant and genial, and a brilliant and well-informed conversationalist on all subjects. He is the associate editor of Hearst's American Weekly, but all of his main interests center in his weird writing. He agrees with me the original Moonpool novelette in the All Story is his best work."
That seems like an uncomfortable conversation to me.
Yeah.
You know, did he really agree with him, or was he just saying it because Lovecraft's like, you know, I liked the short story better than the novel you put out. And he went, oh, yeah, yeah, me too. His feelings were hurt.
Probably.
You know?
He's like, oh, yeah, you know, it's much better. Then he just goes and cries in the corner afterwards.
Yeah.
Our story begins. We are reading a letter to the All Story magazine, and it's from the president of the International Association of Science. It is relaying the story of Dr. Walter T. Goodwin, PhD, who told him of the story of Dr. David Throckmorton. There was some ill-fated expedition that happened with Throckmorton and his wife and the associate of theirs, Dr. Charles Stanton. Throckmorton told Goodwin, and it's Goodwin's story that is the bulk of what we are about to hear.
The whole thing is trying to justify why the Scientific Association would print this account in All Story Weekly. You'd think that they would go to the newspapers, but it says it's because the magazine can print more than the newspapers would, and the readership is large enough so that this is the best way to get the story across to people. And it's fun because it hints at that ill-fated expedition, then says that Goodwin is on a new expedition going to verify the facts of Throckmorton's account. And then it says that the association is mounting an expedition to follow Goodwin. And then it tells the reader, hey, if you read this and you can get an expedition going too, then you should do it, because we all need to find out about the truth of this. And the manuscript actually is going to have maps attached to it for help, so that you can see what the ruins look like. Mm-hmm. And I can see why this stuff would be cut once you publish this outside of the magazine.
Right.
But I thought it was kind of fun. I liked it.
Yeah.
You know, that air of this is something that really happened.
In the Lovecraft's Favorite Weird Fiction book, they actually have the illustrations that came with this story.
Yeah, they have the maps and that kind of stuff, which is helpful, actually, because it's hard to puzzle out sometimes what he's talking about.
Yeah.
The Wikisource version of the short story doesn't have this forward. It just jumps right into the first chapter, the Throckmorton mystery. So let's do the same and get into the story.
So the first chapter of the story is Goodwin telling us the story of meeting Throckmorton.
And first, he just gives us the details that the public may have already heard about this expedition. It says, Dr. Throckmorton set forth, you will recall, to make some observations of Nan Matal, that extraordinary group of island ruins, remains of a high and prehistoric civilization that are clustered along the east shore of Ponape.
Now, this is a real archaeological site called Nan Matal. I don't know if it's just a spelling difference. It's M-A-D-O-L, which means the spaces between. It's in the Caroline Islands. It was the capital of the Sotalur dynasty until around 1628. It's sometimes called Atlantis or the Eighth Wonder of the World or the Venice of the South Pacific due to its many canals. It really does have huge stone construction, and archaeologists aren't quite sure how they were made. And by that, I mean, they can't agree on how they were made. They don't think that aliens came and did it or anything like that.
No.
But legend has it that that this place was made by these twin sorcerers who came there to worship the god of agriculture, and they had to build this great altar with the help of a flying dragon.
Wow, so dragons were involved.
Yeah, if you hit Wikipedia, I mean, this it's a rabbit hole to go down and read about this place. It's awesome.
And there's so many great pictures to look at and really get a sense of what it looks like. I can see why it would capture the imagination of this author.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Throckmorton, he went with his wife, to whom he had been wedded less than half a year. She's the daughter of Professor Fraser Smith, and as such, learned a lot from him. And so she's also educated on this. They want to go check out the relics of this vanished race that titanically strews certain islands of the Pacific, form the basis for a theory of a submerged Pacific continent. I found it was really funny that they only mentioned the wife for quite a while in terms of her relation to other men.
Mm-hmm.
She's Mrs. Throckmorton, then she's the daughter of Professor Fraser Smith. And I'm thinking, does she have a name? Are we ever going to find out? But eventually we find out her name's Edith.
Yes.
And so Throckmorton's basically out to study the remains of this prehistoric civilization on this chain of islands in the Pacific. And accompanying he and Edith is this guy, Dr. Charles Stanton. Now, Throckmorton is about 15 years older than his wife, but Stanton is her age, around 25. And with them is also an older Swedish woman, Thora Halvorsen, who was Edith's nurse when she was young and is still kind of her protector.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the crew of the expedition, and folks know that they plan to spend a year among the ruins. However, when Throckmorton was next seen 3 months later, he appeared at Port Moresby, Papua, alone on a schooner with some natives. And he said, you know, to whomever, he needed to get to Melbourne to get some additional equipment and some white people to help out with his studies because the natives are too superstitious. Maybe they abandoned the expedition. You don't know.
Mm-hmm.
He boards the steamer Southern Queen and then completely disappears 3 nights later. Officially, it's reported that he fell overboard or jumped. Probably a lot of people assume it was an evil mermaid that got him. Maybe that siren from the last story.
That's what I would go for. When they send a boat out to tell the others in the expedition that he's dead, they find the remains of their camp, but they're all gone. There's nobody there, and there doesn't seem to be any trace of where they went or what happened to them.
And the natives are questioned, the people that had been working for Throckmorton, and they say the ruins are the abode of great spirits called Annie, A-N-I, and they're particularly powerful when the moon is full.
Mm-hmm.
Every full moon, the natives would actually leave the expedition because they were afraid of these spirits. So they'd leave those four on their own. And the third time they did this, that's when the whole group vanished.
So Goodwin knows what actually happened. And part of why he's speaking out now is because of a conversation he overheard at his club.
Yeah, basically he heard one guy tell another guy that he thinks the whole thing was the result of a love triangle. Which the minute I heard about, you know, the young guy being on the expedition, I kind of thought about that as well.
Mm-hmm.
This guy thinks that Edith took up with the young assistant, Stanton, and that Throckmorton probably killed them both in a fit of jealousy, then killed himself on board that ship, feeling guilty about it later. So Goodwin is publishing this because he, as it said in the opening, he wants to clean up Throckmorton's reputation as well as his wife and Stanton's. And of course, he also wants to warn the world about some kind of mysterious danger.
Goodwin, too, had been out in the South Pacific writing a book, and he had boarded the Southern Queen with his specimens. He describes how the islands are ancient and brooding, like they're filled with some evil that is waiting to be unleashed.
Lots of description about that.
Lots.
On board the ship, he runs into Throckmorton, and they know each other from previous work, or maybe it was college. I'm not exactly sure what the previous relationship is. But he knows him well, and so he's shocked when he sees the change that's been wrought in Throckmorton's face.
It was as though the man had suffered some terrific soul-searing shock of rapture and horror combined, some soul cataclysm that, in its climax, had remolded his face deep from within, setting on it the seal of wedded joy and fear.
And that's a notion that will come up again and again in the story, this notion of opposites being intertwined, even though it shouldn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
His face reflects both joy and fear at the same time. It's very shocking to behold.
Yeah.
As the ship takes off, we know that Goodwin's going to get the story of what happened from Throckmorton. So that's what gets us into the second chapter, Down the Moon Path.
Goodwin is hoping to run into Throckmorton, but also apprehensive about it. Eventually, that night, he sees Throckmorton up on the deck, and he tells him to take a seat next to him.
Throckmorton, I said, wasting no time in preliminaries. What's wrong? Can I help you? And Throckmorton gives him the same story we already know. Well, here's what's up. I'm going to Melbourne to get some additional stuff, also some non-natives, to help me with my expedition. But then something happens that makes him pause before he says more. It's an overcast night, and for a moment, the full moon breaks out of the clouds. And he seems freaked out for a minute, and then the clouds close again. He turns to Goodwin and says, I do need help. If ever man needed it, I do. Goodwin, can you imagine yourself in another world, alien, unfamiliar, a world of terror whose unknown joy is the greatest terror of all? You all alone there, a stranger. As such a man would need help, so I need. And then boom, again the clouds part and the moon is revealed.
It throws a patch of light on the ocean waves, almost like a path. And it seems like this path is elongating towards the ship.
I thought this was kind of neat imagery. I mean, I could see it. The reflection of the moon on the ocean and that line of light and the reflection slowly moving toward the boat.
Mm-hmm.
It says it was a gleaming, gigantic serpent racing over the rim of the world straight and surely toward the ship.
Throckmorton looks really freaked out and afraid. And then Goodwin says, then for the first time, I saw it.
Far, it seemed immeasurably far along the stream of silver fire I sensed rather than saw something coming. It drew into sight as a deeper glow within the light. Now it was close to the end of the white path, close up to the barrier of darkness still between the ship and the sparkling head of the moon stream. I knew that this was no mist born of sea and air. It whirled with shimmering plumes, with swirls of lacy light, with spirals of living vapor. It held within it odd, unfamiliar gleams as of shifting mother of pearl.
Through his descriptions, we don't know exactly what this thing is, but it's moving along this moon path on the ocean towards the ship.
As it does get close, Goodwin notices these lights inside of it. I was imagining it like it's this tiny tornado of mist and these globes kind of moving around inside of it or not moving.
Yeah.
There are 7 lights inside.
Through all the incessant but strangely ordered movement of the thing, these lights held firm and steady. There were 7. Like 7 little moons. One was of a pearly pink, one of delicate nacreous blue, one of lambent saffron, one of the emerald you see in the shallow waters of tropic isles, a deathly white, a ghostly amethyst, and one of the silver that is seen only when the flying fish leap beneath the moon. There they shone. These 7 little varicolored orbs within the opaline mistiness of whatever it was that, poised and expectant, waited to be drawn to us on the light-filled waves.
And we also get, just like our last story, sounds like tinkling bells.
The way he describes it, we get those contrasts that you mentioned. The tinkling music closed your throat with a throb of rapture and gripped it tight like the hand of infinite sorrow.
Right, somehow he feels both things at once. And then he hears a strange murmuring cry along with the sounds, something utterly foreign to Earth. But if you could guess at the words in the cry, it's something like, Avaloha, Avaloha.
Throckmorton's face is going crazy as he waits for the thing, displaying utter agony and utter ecstasy. But then the clouds close up and the moon is hidden and the thing disappears. Throckmorton is relieved and he says, it was as I thought. He tells Goodwin that now that he's seen it, he can tell him his tale and wants him to come to his cabin. Before they go, he asks one of the crewmen if they're going to continue to have overcast weather, and the crewman says yes, at least for 3 nights, if not more.
He thinks it will be raining all the way to Melbourne, which is encouraging to Throckmorton, because he thinks that if the weather holds, he just might make it. Clearly this thing is after him, but it can only get him if there's moonlight on the waters. So as long as it's overcast, he's okay.
Yeah.
Moonbeams and other stories we've read have been good things to ride, but these seem to be evil moonbeams.
Evil moonbeams, yes.
Yeah, with the evil passengers.
Changing it up.
Mm-hmm.
So Goodwin goes to Throckmorton's cabin, ready to hear the whole story, and that gets us into chapter 3, which is called Dead! All Dead!
That's a good
chapter. That is a good chapter title, yeah. When they get into the cabin, the first thing Throckmorton asks is if Goodwin's got a pocket flashlight, and he hands it over, but Throckmorton thinks it's not big enough. He's got a theory that he could use a flashlight as a weapon against the thing that they saw.
Goodwin says, well, what is it? What are you flying from, man? Where's your wife and Stanton? Dead, he said monotonously. Dead, all dead. Then as I recoiled in horror, Throckmorton says, all dead, Edith, Stanton, Thora, dead or worse. And Edith in the moon pool, with them, drawn by what you saw on the moon path, and that wants me, and that has put its brand upon me, and pursues me.
Then Throckmorton opens his shirt. Around his chest, an inch above his heart, the skin was as white as pearl. The whiteness was sharply defined against the healthy tint of the body. He turned and I saw it ran around his back. It circled him.
Yeah, so he's got this strange ivory band around his whole chest.
Yeah.
He tells Goodwin, burn it with your cigarette. Go ahead. Which, crazily, Goodwin does, like almost immediately. And it doesn't hurt him at all or even make a mark.
Mm-hmm.
When Goodwin feels it, it's like frozen marble, this circle.
Mm.
And urged on by Throckmorton, he cuts into it. He cuts into the band with a penknife.
Yeah.
But the knife just goes in and out, the skin closing up like it was never there.
Yeah.
And Goodwin thinks, do you have leprosy? But Throckmorton says, no, it's nothing so easy. Look, it healed up when you stabbed it.
Yeah.
It says it was as though the skin had parted to make way for the blade and closed. I thought the stuff was pretty weird in kind of a neat way.
Yeah, and I was into this particular stuff, but it's so wrapped around a bunch of really flowery, repetitive language to dig through the track. I could see why somebody would try and edit this thing down.
Totally.
Now that Goodwin has seen the thing on the ocean and the weird bands, Throckmorton is ready to tell him his story. He gets out a map to show him where his expedition went, these ancient ruins called Nan Matal.
There's a network of canals around here. They call it the Venice of the Pacific. So, you know, it's cool that Merritt is using some real discovery to play with the notion of an ancient sunken city and its secrets. And you could see here what would have attracted Lovecraft to the story.
So Throckmorton tells Goodwin to look at the map, at the rectangles marked Nan Tananch. He says, under those walls is the moon pool, the seven gleaming lights that raise the dweller in the pool and the altar and shrine of the dweller. And there in the moon pool, with it lie Edith, Stanton, and Thora.
Throckmorton tells him that the thing he saw is the dweller in the moon pool. The storm outside kicks up, and Throckmorton finally gets into the story that he tells Goodwin. He and his wife had just finished their honeymoon. They're excited to go explore those ruins and to see if they could find suspected subterranean networks there, stuff we already know.
Sure.
They go with their Swedish nurse, the young guy Stanton, and the natives they bring along, you know, want to leave the site during the 3 days of the full moon, which they allow. There's nothing they could do about it.
Yeah.
Now, Throckmorton had wanted to put camp up right along the ruins of Nan Tananch, but the natives were panic-stricken, threatened to turn back. No, they said, too great Ani there. We go to any other place, but not there. So they end up pitching their camp on another site nearby, but far enough to appease the natives.
Right, and that brings us into Chapter 4, The Moon Rock. Or is it The Moon Rock? Throckmorton is not going to reveal what happened those 2 weeks, or what they discovered, not yet at least.
Yeah, he's basically like, it's just not worth getting into because I don't have a lot of time to get the story out. You know, even though the weather prediction is for storms over the next few days, you get the idea that the clouds could break at any time, the moon hits the water again, and then that thing will come back for him. So I kind of like that device. It puts a clock on, you know, get the story out.
Yeah.
Skip some unnecessary details.
Yeah, only some, though. Throckmorton, Stanton, and Edith don't mind the place at first, but it's Thora that is weirded out by the whole thing. She has this Northland intuition about the place. She said that it smelled of ghosts and warlocks.
I like that line a lot. And if they sold candles with those scents, I would totally buy them.
Yes, me too.
Yeah.
So the leader of the group of the natives, of the native helpers, reminds them that the natives are not going to be around the island when the full moon is out.
Yeah, after the 2 weeks, that's about to happen. So they're all taking off.
They will return in 3 nights' time. Since the workers are gone, Throckmorton and gang use this time to explore the smaller islands around Ushantau.
On the last of the 3 nights, something weird happens.
Yeah, Throckmorton is awakened by his wife. She tells him to put his ear close to the ground and listen. And there's this sound of faint chanting, and then it fades away. Now, he tries to dismiss it, says it's the sound of waves crashing, but then they hear it again. And this time, there's more tinkling sounds, almost like music. And he says it was the sound that he and Goodwin heard up on the deck earlier.
Mm.
Throckmorton goes out of his tent, and as he does, Stanton is leaving his tent as well. And they look out over at the island Nan Tananch and see lights. And they figure the natives are doing some kind of ritual and are trying to keep it private from the white people.
Which is why they actually left for 3 days. To participate in this ritual, not because they're afraid. That's what maybe they're guessing anyway.
So Stan wants to go over and spy on them and see what's going on. But Throckmorton says that would really tick off the natives and they can't risk them not returning. So Stan goes, you know, you're right. The strange tinkling music, if music it could be called, rose and fell, now laden with sorrow, now filled with joy. So again, that whole sorrow, sadness, happiness, joy, all in one.
It gets tiresomely repeated in the story. This best of times business. But the cool thing here is that it sounds like there are thousands of people chanting over at Nan Tananch. Throckmorton says, I thought this might be due to some acoustic property of the basalt, an amplification of sound by some gigantic sounding board of rock. Still, it's devilish uncanny, broke in Stanton, answering my thought.
Then Thora comes out of her tent. She looks across to the lights and she sees something. Being a superstitious Swede, she can see things that others cannot, or at least that's what Throckmorton thinks.
Yeah, suddenly she raised her arms and made a curious gesture to the moon. It's like she's in a trance or something.
Yeah.
It was an archaic movement. She seemed to drag it from remote antiquity, yet in it was a strange suggestion of power. Twice she repeated this gesture and the tinkling died away.
She says, go from here and quickly. Go while you may. They have called. They know you are here. They wait. It is there. It beckons. The. And then Thor just falls down at Edith's feet, and the tinkling sound increases. Now, Stanton and Throckmorton run to her and roll her over, and she has this horrified look on her face. They think it's some kind of nervous seizure, maybe, that she's experiencing. So they take her into the tent, and they put her to sleep. In the morning, Thor wakes up with no memory of the night before.
There's some interesting stuff in here where Throckmorton is bemoaning the fact that he didn't listen to her or the natives who asked them to leave.
Mm-hmm.
He's basically saying what I call superstition is just them actually being more in touch with history in this area.
Yeah.
And I found it interesting because he's basically saying these people are more intelligent.
Yeah.
We whites are the ignorant ones because we're so confident in our science and reason. You know, we should have listened to these guys.
So the natives return that morning, happy to see that everyone is alive and well. Stanton jokes with their leader that they must have had a pretty good night with all those lights that they saw on the island. And this horrifies the native leader.
Yeah.
Stanton then tries to play it off like it was a joke, but it's too late. They know they saw some stuff.
Yeah.
So the natives decide to pitch their tent on the opposite side of the island away from Natanach.
Yeah, they don't even want to see it.
So Throckmorton and Stanton have a theory that the people have some kind of tunnel, maybe, that leads between islands, but they have no proof of that.
They do decide that the next time the natives bug out on the 3 days of the full moon, though, they're going to go immediately to Natanach and see what they can figure out with what's going on there.
So a month goes by and the next full moon comes around. The natives beg the party to come with them this time, but of course they refuse. Throckmorton laments to Goodwin that he wishes he'd listened to them. After the natives leave, they set off immediately for Natanach. He goes into a very lengthy description of the way the island structure is built. There is an inner courtyard on the island where there is a large stone vault.
As you said, there were actual maps included in the anthology, which was helpful because the descriptions don't exactly... I wasn't exactly sure what everything looked like.
Yeah.
But they go to this inner courtyard in the ruins of Natanach. This part was interesting. It says, "There lies the great central vault with which is associated the one name of living being that has come to us out of the mists of the past. The natives say it was the treasure house of Kau-Telur, a mighty king who reigned long before their fathers.
Mm-hmm.
As Kau is the ancient Ponopean word for both sun and king, the name means place of the sun king. And opposite this place of the sun king is the moon rock that hides the moon pool."
Right.
So there's this name in here that really sounds like an earlier version of Cthulhu.
Oh, yeah.
It's got the same syllable construction, Cthulhu.
Right.
So perhaps Lovecraft kind of lifted that from
maybe.
The story. Maybe. I mean, seems like a pretty clear connection. Although in these ruins, he's the good guy, right? Or at least he's the light god. It's the moon spirits that are bad, I think.
So Stanton is the one who discovers this huge stone slab, 15 feet tall, 10 feet wide. It's more gray than the other rocks around it. And when Throckmorton touches it, it gives him this gentle jolt of what he calls frozen electricity.
He says the stone has a smooth, peculiar deadness to it.
Stanton says that he felt the same thing, too, when he first touched it. The rock is cut in such a way that it has, he says, almost jeweler's detail, because the rocks line up so well that there's only a hair width separating the stones. When all the other stones in the courtyard are worn and weathered, the slab stone is smooth, and Stanton deduces that it's some kind of door by the way that it's built.
There's an indentation in the ground and the rock underneath. It's like a smooth cup almost, and he thinks that's from the door opening and closing.
They try to figure out how to open it when Throckmorton looks up and he screams a startled scream. He says because there are convex parts to the rock, and I don't know why that would be startling to him.
Yeah, it was a little confusing. I think it had something to do with it being almost dangerous because it's a optical illusion. You can't tell that there's rock jutting out over your head until you're right up against the door and look up. And there you see these kind of indentations that jut out a little bit. I thought. Regardless, up above them there are these indentations, and within these there are 7 circles an inch wide in the curved place, each of which communicated the precise sensation I have described.
And if you remember, there were 7 orbs floating around inside that creature. Throckmorton goes up a ladder and he touches them, and he thinks that they are the key to opening the door. He doesn't know why he thinks that. It's just an intuition. They think they won't be able to figure out how to open it and that blowing it up may be the only way to get inside. But the thought of that fills him with dread. And just then, Thor approaches the men.
"Miss Edith wants you quick," she began, and stopped. I saw her eyes go past me and widen. She was looking at the gray rock. Her body grew suddenly rigid. She took a few stiff steps forward and then ran straight to it. We saw her cast herself upon its breast, hands and face pressed against it, heard her scream as though her very soul was being drawn from her, and watched her fall at its foot. As we picked her up, I saw steel from her face, the look I had observed when I had first heard the crystal music of Nan Tanach. That unhuman mingling of opposites.
Again, that mingling of opposites, and that's the end of the fourth chapter, and it's where we're going to have to pause for now.
Yes.
Next week, we'll be back with the conclusion of this story. I think you read a little further than I have. I've only read up to here, but what are you thinking about it so far? Yeah.
I'm not particularly impressed with the story or the writing, okay. Actually. There's some cool ideas, and I think if maybe a better writer told this story, it could be really cool.
I don't know.
But that's just my opinion. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, maybe it was my mood while I was reading it. I don't know. I was kind of into it. I like Lost Civilization stuff, and this was weird enough that it was keeping my attention because I don't know what happens when you got a tornado with seven smoke bubbles in it coming toward a boat. And
strangely, neither do I.
Yeah. So it's kind of neat. I don't know how it's going to turn out. I do know that a couple of years ago, I got a pair of Throckmorton boots and they fell apart right away.
Really?
Yeah, they're a knockoff of
quality. Yeah.
Pay more and get the Doc Martens. Don't get the Throckmortons. Once again, I want to thank Andrew Lehman for being our reader. We're always so happy to have him back on the show.
You know you're screaming for some more Andrew Lehman.
Everybody's screaming for more Andrew Lehman. And if you are screaming for more Lehman, make sure to go over to hplhs.org and pick up many of the amazing offerings of the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society.
So good.
We also, of course, as always, want to thank our patrons. I got a list of some of them here. First person I want to thank is our old friend Rafe Ball.
Oh, Rafe Ball, your contributions to the comments are indispensable. And I want to thank David Crossman.
I also want to thank Edward.
Daniel Vernon, thank you.
James Birdsall, thank you so much.
Zane Schwartfeger, thank you.
Thank you, Stephen Moore.
Thank you, Phil Nadeau.
And thank you so much, Richard Butler.
Last but not least, I want to thank Steph Chomp.
Steph Chomp. The handle for Stephanie. Yeah, thank you, Stephanie. We're glad to have you all as patrons. And again, thank you for being part of the team. We're going to get back to the second part of the Moon Pool here in our month of, exploration.
Yes. And for those of you that subscribe at the higher patron levels, you can get some awesome bonus content. This month, we are going to be covering the old Boris Karloff film, Die, Monster, Die.
Right. It's apparently an adaptation of The Color Out of Space, and we have talked about it so much over the years, I've never watched it.
Yeah.
So we decided we're going to give that a peep, and then on our bonus content, we'll talk all about it, whether it's faithful to the story, if it's got any new interesting stuff in it. Karloff is looking sweet in it, which he probably is, because he's Karloff.
Always.
But that's what's coming up, and for now, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com. Thank you.